KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates held as a virtual meeting during the COVID pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
And so there's an opportunity for the public to participate and potentially ask Mr. Moron a question themselves. So I would really encourage folks to participate and to tune in. The idea of these workshops that the Intergovernmental Collaborative Group has put together is really to try to engage the community and enrich our civil discourse on how we address persistent issues in our community to make life better. I see Greg wants to speak.
And then we do need to get up to our KPTZ time slot. But go ahead, Greg.
Really quickly, as Kate talking about having conversations about stakeholders about childcare and everything, and just do remember that the 7th and Hendricks Projects has 20 kids of childcare baked into that project. So just to make sure that's part of the conversation.
Right, so Head Start still the provider there?
Great. Yes.
Good. Okay, it is 9:45. We are joined by KPTZ and Dr. Locke and Willie Bentz. Welcome.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Glad to have you here. We'll hand it over to you.
Get my mic on here. good morning. Starting with the epidemiology, we're now clearly on the declining side of the third wave, both nationally and in Washington State. So nationally, I'm sorry, I just got an error on my.
I think you got muted also, Dr. Locke. We are not able to hear you. Are you able to hear us? I wonder.
No, it looks like he's fine.
Am I back? Yeah. I lost my connection.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. Sorry, that was an internet problem. So I was saying we've seen a significant drop in the U.S. Cases are actually down 40% from the January 8th peak, and hospitalization rates have also gone down nationally by about 24%. But this is from the highest level yet, so we're still at a very high level. It's just not as bad as it was in the early part of January. And likewise, Washington State has had a very similar drop, 52% decrease in cases from the January peak and about a 19% drop in hospitalizations. But statewide, we're still at 392 cases per 100,000 over a two-week period. And positivity of tests is 9.6%. So these are still very high levels. In Jefferson County, we've had an increase, actually a tripling in number of cases over the last week. So in the prior week, we had a relatively low number, 8 cases, and then this last week, we've had 26 cases, and so that brings our case rate in Jefferson County has gone from 72 per 100,000 to 106.58 per 100,000, and so we're now higher than Clallam County. Clallam County's rate, at least on their website, is published at 84 per 100,000, and their positivity is at 3.2%. Kitsap is at 155 and 7.3% positivity. And Mason County is listed at 174 and with 14% positivity. And this week, I'm seeing real divergence between what the state reports our rates and what the counties are reporting. And I tend to trust the county rates, that the state continues to have problems with the accuracy of their reporting. So things are improving, but we're still at a very high level, and the risk of being exposed to this infection is still very high throughout Washington State, and even higher in many states within the U.S. I wanted to talk just a bit. I'm getting a lot of questions about variants and what that means and what the significance of it is. And it is a very concerning and in many ways inevitable problem that we need to face with a out of control global pandemic, because all viruses mutate over time. As they copy themselves, they make errors. And very, very rarely those errors benefit the virus. What is happening with these variants we're noticing are changes are occurring in the spike protein on the surface. And this is the protein that the virus uses to attach to our cells and invade those cells. And it's also the target for our vaccines. The virus mutates, the shape of the spike protein changes. And if that shape allows it to more efficiently attach to cells, then it becomes more contagious. And if the change, if the shape changes in a way that it makes the antibodies we develop, either from a vaccine or from a natural infection, if it makes these antibodies less able to attach to that spike protein, then it becomes more resistant to that immunity. And that's what's happening in four different strains that we're tracking now. What we're calling the UK strain is the one we think will likely become predominant in the US over the next month to month and a half. It's one that it's thought to be about 50% more contagious. We initially thought that it was no more serious in terms of severity of infection, but there is some data out of Britain now that suggests it might cause more serious illness. There's a Brazilian strain that appears to be more contagious. There's a strain out of California that's more contagious, but not more lethal. And then what's most concerning to us is a South African variant strain that is not only more contagious, but has some vaccine resistance. So that the vaccine still has effect on it, but less effect. And people who get this, who have had prior forms of COVID-19 and have immunity based on that, can get, if exposed to the South African variant, they can get that. So prior infection is not as protective with the South African variant. So what this all means, that I think the most important lesson in this is we need to get a lot more serious about our public health control measures. There are still states in this nation that are treating the pandemic as if it's something that if dealing with it is somehow optional. Or a matter of political ideology. There are 13 states that still have no masking requirements. The state of Wisconsin just recently repealed theirs. The Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate, repealed their mask mandate, even though they're still having severe spread. So we as a country have not really come together with a national control plan, and we need it. And if we don't do that and do it soon, these variants are going to become the predominant form of infection, and the pandemic will get even worse, and vaccines will be less effective. So anyone who's been on the fence about the need to masking and distancing and hand hygiene, they need to get off the fence. That these kind of failure to do these things that we know prevents transmission, you're not only jeopardizing your own health and your family's health, but you're jeopardizing the public's health, because those behaviors promote spread of variants. And then finally, the variants are making the urgency of us getting as many people vaccinated as soon as possible even more urgent. But that's always been something that's been very urgent to us. Also getting a lot of questions, a lot of the KPTZ questions about where we are with vaccination efforts. So we've certainly been moving as rapidly as we can in Jefferson County, limited really only by the availability of the vaccine. There's been the reports, the current report, 5,019 doses of the vaccine have been administered in Jefferson County, and about 90% of those by the hospital district, and about 10% by local pharmacies. And our plan is to keep this up. The hospital has now had a confirmed order. We'll be receiving another 1,000 doses, which are for completion of the first dose. So to complete the second dose on people who have already received the first dose, and then they're hoping to get more first dose vaccine this week, but it hasn't been confirmed yet. The hospital did get a small amount of Moderna vaccine last week, which we've been using to target some very high-risk populations. So people on cancer chemotherapy, people who are over 75 and also have other major risk factors. So that's been very helpful. But we need way more. And we hear from the state that the vaccine supplies have increased slightly. This week, Washington State's expecting to get 155,000 doses, and 105,000 of those will be available for first doses, and then 49, almost 50,000 will be to complete the second dose. There was a question from a KPTC listener, now that the state has told us we should use all the vaccine we get, is that going to affect the availability for second dose? And I think the answer to that, fortunately, is no. What it means is the state's taking over management, inventory management of the second dose. And so essentially they will guarantee us a second dose for any first dose that's administered. So that actually makes it easier for us. We don't have to hold any vaccine behind or hold any in reserve. We give it as soon as we get it. In fact, that's a requirement, is all vaccine needs to be administered within 7 days of receipt. And of course, we're trying to do it even faster than that, if possible. We're doing better statewide in terms of getting the vaccine administered. We have documentation that now 62% of vaccine that's been distributed has been administered. The number's probably higher than that, but the record keeping systems are really not fully up to speed. So not everyone who's administering the vaccine appears to be reporting it in a timely fashion. But essentially, right now, Washington is administering this vaccine as fast as we're getting it in. So those delays have been overcome. What's impairing supplies to Jefferson County is that the state is reallocating the vaccine within the state. So it's directing more of it to counties that received less early on, and it's redirecting vaccine to support some of these large-scale mass vaccination events that the National Guard and others have been doing. And there's reasons behind all of that, but it makes the Jefferson County vaccine supply very unpredictable. We would like to be scheduling appointments, but we can't do it if we don't know if there's going to be vaccine to support those appointments. We are expecting this to stabilize within a couple weeks. So we will, we hope by mid-February that we'll be in a situation where we will know every week, hopefully several weeks in advance, how much vaccine we'll be getting, and then we'll be able to give people some predictability as to where they are in line and how long it's going to take to get through the different age tiers. But right now, the priority is using the vaccine to save lives. And that means prioritizing it based on age. Currently, it's people 75 years of age over, and especially people in this age cohort who have other medical conditions which put them at risk for COVID complications. Any questions from the board before I try to answer a few more KPTZ questions?
Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the roadmap and I don't know. Disabuse me of some of my fears that the state does not seem to be going based on data when you have the I-5 corridor with the much higher incident rate, much higher positivity rates in phase two, and our small businesses still unable to move back to where they were.
Yeah, I've given several candid press reviews on this recently, but it really represents how a flawed methodology can lead to flawed decision making, and that the using percentage changes in rates is really not a good way to predict exposure risk, and so we see that in King County, which has approximately four times the rate of COVID transmission as Jefferson County, because their hospitalization rate has improved slightly, they, under this methodology, they now meet three of the four criteria for reopening. But that does not change the fact that the risk of exposure is four times greater there. And therefore, if people use restaurants to get together with friends and non-household members, and sit down within a few feet of each other and take their masks off and eat and drink and do that for over a half an hour, which is almost always the case, that is a high-risk situation for COVID transmission. And it doesn't just affect King County because King, Pierce, Snohomish, because a lot of our cases in Jefferson County are from out-of-county exposure. That we have people who work in the I-5 corridor or need to, for whatever reason, travel back and forth. I think that's a very unfortunate consequence of it. And I know some people look at this as, well, it's unfair for the low-risk counties, but based on what we're facing, I don't think it's a good idea for anyone to go to this full phase two changes. Some of the phase two changes are probably low risk, some of the sports things, for instance. But we really have concerns about people increasing indoor exposures. We just do not seem to be in the point of the pandemic that we can afford to do that now. And with what we're concerned about is we are going to see consequences of this. It will take 2 to 4 weeks for the data to show up, but already cases are going up in King County. It's hard to believe that won't be accelerated by restaurant reopenings, which is the big risk factor.
And I guess to follow up, just, you know, part of this is just wanting to convention. I know that you and Commissioner Dean have already been advocating, but is there a way that we can advocate or should advocate about this? And then also, what about just the changing rules? I mean, we met three of the metrics for the first 2 weeks they were doing this, and then as soon as King County did, they shifted the metrics. I mean, it just seems so arbitrary and politically motivated to my way of analysis.
Well, and it's not even going to meet the needs of the businesses, because this methodology will, it'll change week to week. So places that are open for 2 weeks will then have to close because the metrics will get worse. And it's just, until we get the prevalence rates down all over the state, I think we need to be working together as a state. I mean, if the emergence of these variants teaches us anything, it's that we are all, like it or not, we are all in this together. We are all the counties of the state, all the states of this nation, and all the nations of the world. Our fates are intertwined on this. And if we, if there's a weak link in that chain, it will have consequences for everyone else. And so I think people have been looking at this just through the lens of individual risk for too long, and we have to finally look at it as a true public health problem.
Well, so, shouldn't you take the invitation for a dinner party in Seattle next week?
I would recommend against that, and unless you're in these like full hospital PPE, then you might be able to pull it off.
Okay. Thank you.
Heidi?
Can you just read? I've been receiving a ton of questions from my neighbors about when can I get vaccinated. Our best resource for information is still the Jefferson Healthcare COVID page, correct?
Yes. Yep. Yes. And we're trying to, you know, that has, since the hospital right now is the predominant source of vaccine, they're doing 90% of the vaccination. They are trying to be as transparent as possible about, they can't schedule appointments now because they don't have vaccine. But as soon as they get it, they'll open it up again. And everybody understands why everyone would like to be vaccinated as soon as possible. But that is impossible. It's absolutely impossible. And it's not going to be made better by people stressing themselves out and trying to compete for this very limited resource. I mean, we have no choice but to be patient and wait till supplies increase, and you know, it will be available. You know that's guaranteed. But some people who want to be vaccinated now are not going to be able to be vaccinated for a month or two. It's all based on supply of the vaccine, and supply of the vaccine is completely out of our control. It's based on national production.
So some of the people, one couple that talked to me, they're 80 years old, and I said, well, you should be registered. You should get registered because you will be eligible as soon as there's vaccine. But, you know, other people are kind of all over the board, and people are hearing that if I go to the pharmacy, I might be able to get vaccinated because they're using different criteria. Have you heard that? Or?
Well, we're legally, they have to use the state's criteria, which allows them to vaccinate people 65 years of age and older. We have strongly recommended that they follow the same criteria that the hospital is, but you know, their parts, at least QFC and Safeway are, you know, they're national chains, and they kind of make their own decisions. But the bottom line is the pharmacies have very small amounts of vaccine. you know, they get 100 or 200 doses a week at the most. And so it's a drop in the bucket. But if someone is able to get vaccinated at a pharmacy, great. We encourage people, healthy people in the 65 to 75 age band, we ask them to step back and allow people who are at much higher risk of complications to go ahead of them. Whether they'll do that or not, I don't know. But the overriding priority right now is to try to save lives, is to try to get people vaccinated who are at risk of dying of COVID-19.
So there you go, Mom. There's your answer. You can wait. You heard Dr. Locke say it. I know you're listening. The last part of my three-part question is, I've heard about these mass vaccination events, and there's rumor of one that's going to happen in our area. What do you know about those? I'm just asking the obvious question.
Well, we're very actively planning for the day when vaccine supplies increase, and they will, you know, and we're hoping that it will be in this next month. But when we have enough vaccine, when we have vaccine supplies that exceed the capacity of the hospital and the pharmacies, then we'll move to mass vaccination events. We submitted a detailed plan to the state on Friday as to how we're going to do this. And we're really looking at using high school gymnasiums, similar to what they're doing in Port Angeles. And they've been able to vaccinate about 600 people a day. They're hoping to get up to like 1,000 doses a day. That's a pretty long day to do it, but it is feasible. So we are recruiting volunteers. Willie and his emergency management folks are working very actively on this. So, and our goal is to, by the time, as soon as we have vaccine available, we will be ready to do mass vaccination events. Because we're gonna need to use everything possible to, you know, to get, we think probably 80% of Jefferson County residents, somewhere between 70% and 80%, will want to be vaccinated. So that's about 25,000-26,000 people, and that's going to take a lot of capacity, because we want to do it as quickly as possible. We want to use, as soon as the vaccine comes in, we want to administer it within a matter of days.
Thank you.
So I'm jumping on a couple of things, and one, I'm hoping that when it's Lily's turn, he will speak to this question of where do people go for information. So that's something we have been talking quite a bit about, is how will we start spreading information when it's not just Jefferson Healthcare doing the vast majority of vaccination. But I have to do something administrative here, which is I'm going to be jumping off to go testify in a hearing for the legislature. So I need to authorize that I will pass on chairing to Greg Brotherton in my absence when I suddenly disappear, and excuse me, in advance for an abrupt departure, just waiting on that bill to be called up. Quick question for you, Dr. Locke. I know that some of the recent cases are at a residential facility. What is your level of concern around community transmission, given that a number of those cases did not appear to be from community contact, but instead a residential facility?
Yeah, I'm limited in what I can say about particular outbreaks, but we, you know, this is one we're working really hard on, and using our standard and very effective containment strategy. So we are able, in some ways, outbreaks are the easiest thing to contain because we know everybody in the facility, and so we can test everybody, we can quarantine everyone, we can isolate anyone who tests positive. So given that level of control, we think that this is completely containable. The problem with these always is they've spread by the time we know about them. So by the time an outbreak is detected, a lot of people have been exposed and a lot of people have been infected. But this is happening all the time around the state. You know, we are dealing with outbreaks on a more or less continuous basis. This is a larger one than we've had in Jefferson County, although most counties have had many, many more of these than we have. In Kitsap County, there's about a dozen of these going on every day. So, bottom line, this is well within our capabilities to control, and we think we're largely there. But it's this is enormously time consuming for our staff to do these kind of outbreak control efforts.
So, you were mentioning from the last 2 weeks a tripling of case count. So you're not seeing a significant uptick in community transmission that concerns you? In other words, are we trending in the wrong direction, or is this a one-time blip?
There have been other outbreaks too in this time period on a smaller scale. So we are seeing clusters of infection, and that is less concerning than if we saw 26 unrelated cases within the county. That would be a very significant difference than clusters where 14 or 15 people got infected all in one location. Because, as I say, those are easier to control. That's one big fire as opposed to 26 small fires all over, widely dispersed.
Kate, I have a couple of questions. So, one is, I heard you say that you're not looking forward from a epidemiological perspective of any counties moving into phase two, but that's also an area that our businesses certainly have a real interest in. Looking at, the metrics for in the governor's plan, there needs to be, in addition to having percent ICU occupancy and percent positivity on case rate of with tests being within certain ranges, there needs to be a decline of 10% or more, either in case rate or in hospital admission rate. Do you have a sense of how both Jefferson County and our four county region is maybe trending this week and into the future in those two metrics?
Well, both of the metrics are very low. I mean, among the lowest in the state, in Clallam and Jefferson. So what's really driving it is Kitsap and Mason. And we have less, that data is less available to us. It comes through state sources. But that especially Kitsap is where the bulk of the population is, and therefore the bulk of cases. So that's going to drive reopening plans in this region. And then Mason County has relatively high transmission rates for a county of its size, and it has the Shelton Correctional Facility. It has high numbers because it's a medical facility. It's where you are sent if you have severe COVID complications in the prison system.
Oh, wow. So no crystal balling of where we may be heading as a region?
We're always hopeful that things will get better, especially as the weather improves and people can do more outdoors. We're hopeful too that levels will drop around the state to the point that it makes it safe to resume these kind of activities that everyone wants to do. But if we do it at a time when transmission rates are high, given the fact that people are still not that serious about doing the things they need to prevent transmission, the rates are, or the consequences are predictable. It'll be this yo-yo effect. Things will go down, will open up, they'll go up, will close down, and And that is becoming more dangerous as these variant strains spread and the virus becomes more contagious. So those kind of high-risk activities result in more cases.
Yeah, I do want to make sure I understand the way the metrics are going to be looked at. So as of February 1st, everything's kind of locked for 2 weeks. Is that right? So we're really, our stopwatch starts now. So what is our rate for the next 2 weeks on these four metrics is all that's important. It doesn't matter how low our hospitalization rate is, only what happens in the next 2 weeks.
Right. And the thing that is fundamentally irrational, it doesn't matter what your starting point is. You know, if you're very low, you have to go even lower.
If you're very high, you have to have negative 10, basically.
And whereas if you're very high, if you just have a modest improvement, then that somehow means that it implies it's safe for you to reduce your transmission prevention, which it's not. It just that's not how infectious diseases work. Infectious diseases do not care about percentage changes. They only care about absolute prevalence.
Sorry, I wasn't trying to get into my rant again, but it's easy for me to slip there right now. But other question is, I rock two masks today. Are we in two mask territory right now? Should people start wearing two cloth masks simultaneously?
I'm a fan of two masking. The inner one should be a surgical type mask. So mixing the materials improves the efficiency. So a surgical mask on the inside and then a cloth mask on the outside to improve the fit of the surgical mask. And we're waiting for data from the CDC on this, but it appears to be an improvement over both cloth masks alone or surgical masks. The surgical type masks are now pretty readily available. And we recommend that in if you're in high risk situations, like you're going to a grocery store, you're going to a public place where there are a lot of people. In office settings and when your goal is just to do source control, to trap urine secretions, any kind of mask works well for that.
Great, thank you.
Some of the questions in public comment today were related to the PCR tests and the cycle counts that are being used. One thing they were commenting on, I think, on the cycle count at Jefferson Healthcare, but my understanding is that's a small fraction of the tests that are being conducted for Jefferson County. Most of them are being done, I think, out of UW or a lab somewhere over there. They were calling into question whether a high cycle count positive test actually was legitimately a coronavirus in concentrations that would be either viable or contagious.
Yeah, I mean, this is an old argument that, you know, people who want to minimize the pandemic are using, is that some of the positive tests are not real positives. All of those tests, the cycle count just means that there's a low amount of virus in the swab. It doesn't, you know, it can mean that you did a bad swab test. You didn't capture much virus. It can mean that the person has a low amount of virus in their nose. It can mean that they're in the convalescent phase of the infection, so they have less virus for that reason. It can mean that they're in the very early phase of it. Those tests are actually highly accurate. A positive PCR is a real infection, and you can only tell where that person is in the course of that infection by interviewing or examining the person. So it's I'm really increasingly looking at these nitpicky diagnostic things as a form of COVID denialism. People that somehow don't want to believe that this is a serious problem. And now that kind of denialism is becoming more dangerous. If people do not want to accept that the pandemic has the potential of getting even worse, they should look at the variant data and try to explain that away.
Well, I think the most telling statistics that corroborate that this is for real are the ICU hospitalizations and death statistics. Those don't lie. And so, so get over it.
Yeah. And get on board. Start taking this seriously, and together we can get to the other end of it.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So excuse me.
No, just I wonder if there's anything else for Dr. Locke or from Dr. Locke before we move on to Willie.
I thought maybe we could move on to Willie, make sure he has some time, and then if you have extra time, I can tackle a few more KPTZ questions.
Okay. Welcome, Willie.
Hey, thank you. I'll be relatively quick. Just kind of a broken record here, but bears repeating, and I want to thank everyone who's reached out and offered their assistance at the community vaccination sites or at the Jefferson Healthcare site. We've had nearly 200 non-clinical volunteers reach out to us. So that's folks just kind of helping out with administration, traffic control, that kind of thing. And then 40 to 50 clinical volunteers, so retired doctors, nurses who can actually help out on the medical side. The frustrating part is we haven't actually gotten enough vaccine to really put them to work yet. So I wanted to thank everyone for their patience and really reiterate that we're taking a long-term approach to this, and just because we're not rushing out all 250 plus volunteers right away doesn't mean the need isn't going to be there. So we appreciate their patience. We're going to be putting them to work. We're still going to need additional volunteers down the line. Because one thing they're finding at Jefferson Healthcare is that a lot of this work is exhausting. Over the course of a 5 or 6 hour shift, one worker working traffic control walked nearly 7 miles over the course of her shift. So we need folks who are going to be physically fit, pretty active. We need a lot of volunteers because this is going to be exhausting. So please do continue to reach out to us, even if it's not now, if it's a month from now, 2 months from now. We're going to need really the whole community to get behind this effort and help respond. So again, thank you to everyone. We're sorry we haven't been able to throw you in the fire right away. But again, we're going to be needing lots and lots of help over the coming months. So I appreciate that there. One thing that was asked of us is whether or not volunteers are going to be vaccinated before they begin their work. And at this time, they are not, specifically because, as Dr. Locke mentioned, we need to focus on the most vulnerable among us, those likely to perish if they acquire the virus, or those first responders who are working directly with those who are suspected or confirmed to actually have it. That being said, those volunteers who we will have working sooner than later, while vaccine supply is still limited, they're going to be outfitted with a full scope of medical grade PPE. There are protections in place to keep them safe. And these are really tried and true methods that have been protecting healthcare workers and others for a pretty extended period of time. Once vaccine supply does become more available, though, then we will look at vaccinating our volunteers into the full. But at this point in time, again, given the limited supplies, we're going to look at protecting you with PPE, with social distancing, with screening of patients, et cetera. So I'll leave that up to the individuals as to whether or not they're comfortable with that level of risk, or they want to wait until a little bit later on to ensure that they can get vaccinated as part of their regular volunteer work. On the communications front, Jefferson Healthcare's website does continue to be the best sole source point of information. For information about the vaccination effort, and when and if that does change, once there are more community sites available, we will let you know both during this briefing as well as on that site. So keep your eye out there. I think one really interesting and really positive change they did make, and this was something Commissioner Dean had asked about last week, if you're 65 or older, even though you aren't included in their age band vaccination targets quite yet, you can sign up to receive an email when you become available to receive the vaccine. So that's only if you're 65 and older and not part of that 75 plus group quite yet. But let's say you're 66, you can go onto that site, sign up, and receive an email when your segment of the age band does become available. So I recommend everyone 65 to 75 hop on that site and sign up for that email list so they can get that email right away when they're available to sign up for their appointment. The last thing I will note for those of you kind of piggybacking on the discussion about the phased reopening, the state does have a website that shows all those metrics in a dashboard so you can stay up to date there. Coronavirus.wa.gov, and that's actually the best point of information at state level on coronavirus information. So head there, you can actually see the metrics. I won't rehash that conversation too much, but go there, look for yourself, and kind of see some of the stuff that we're talking about. The next recalculation of those metrics will be February 12th. So I'd encourage everyone to head to that page on the 12th. And then the next eligibility for advancement in phases will be that Monday, February 15th. So that's when we'll find out if Jefferson County and the rest of our region is moving on to the next phase. And then again, February 15th would be that first potential date for us to move forward, or like Dr. Lux spoke to, for others to potentially move back. Again, given that they're looking at trends and rates, and you can actually be rewarded for being bad or being terrible and then going to merely bad, as opposed to maintaining doing pretty well as we've been. So that's all I've got, unless there are any questions.
Willie, just a quick question that I brought up a little earlier. Any update on kind of best place for information? I know we were saying still Jefferson Healthcare's website. Any update or anticipated change in that?
No anticipated change at this point in time. But like I said, assume if there at any point that kind of transitions, again, we might look at a county website being that sole point, given increased vaccination efforts. We'll make that announcement on Jefferson Healthcare's page. We'll partner with them to get that on there and direct you to the best point in time. So I'd say continue to monitor that page, continue to monitor that coronavirus.wa.gov at the state level, and then we'll be sure to keep everyone abreast of changes. But right now, there are, I can say there's no imminent plans to change that for the time being.
Okay, thank you. So let's see. We have some more time. We don't have anything on our agenda until 11 o'clock. Is that right, Philip? Or we have more?
Well, we have the sheriff joining us.
Oh, right. Okay. So we could take a couple more questions. Should we go maybe until 10:40 with Dr. Locke? And then
yes. No later than that, certainly.
Great.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll watch the time. But did, as usual, had some great KPTZ questions. I've already covered a number of them. One asked, how are the long-term care facilities going? How's vaccination going there? And unfortunately, that's been way slower than we wanted. The way that worked is that the federal government contracted with some national pharmacy chains, CVS and Walgreens. They were given 3 weeks to vaccinate everyone in long-term care facilities, and they failed to do that. Fortunately, in Jefferson County, we were able to offer all the staff of the long-term care facility vaccine in that early phase, so in mid to late December. So we think we were able to vaccinate almost all the staff, and in the later part of January, the pharmacies started vaccinating the long-term care residents. So that's ongoing, and we hope they will complete it in the next week. But it's way behind schedule, and I'm not exactly sure why.
In national news, I heard that there is a low compliance rate of long-term care staff in being willing to get vaccinated. How has it been here?
I don't know. That's a great question. I'll look into that and see if we do know, because, you know, given the fact that we offered them all vaccination, we have some information about that. But I actually haven't seen a number reported. And yes, I am aware that that was a national problem. There was a question about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So now we're starting to get the phase three data on that. It appears to be in the 70% or so effectiveness, and people may think that's not as good as a 95% vaccine, but that's actually a very good vaccine, and much more convenient to administer because it's a one dose vaccine. We think that the vaccine will likely not be available commercial. It hasn't even been licensed yet, but even when it is, they will not have significant supplies till sometime in March or early April. But they are committed to making 100 million doses for the United States sometime, they say, in the spring. It will be available in the spring. So that will be a huge surge in vaccine availability and very welcome. There was a question about why Governor Inslee's rationale behind teachers not being given a higher priority for vaccine. And the rationale for this is that the governor was really clear that his highest priority was saving lives. And as occupational settings go, schools are a low-risk place for transmission, and that's a good thing. That's why we're able to reopen schools. If everyone follows the rules with masking and distancing and hygiene standards, it's one of the safest places you can be, is in a school. And so that really guided the governor's thinking, and teachers were given a high priority. They are certainly considered essential workers, along with law enforcement and other people whose jobs are very essential to the functioning of society. But based on mortality risk, they put teachers in essential worker category, and also under the current priorities, it's for teachers 50 years of age and older, and that's based on lack of adequate vaccine. So that's a pure rationing decision based on lack of vaccine availability. As vaccine availability increases, we think that will go away. And actually, when we get to vaccinating teachers, we would like to be able to do all ages, because it just make it easier for us to do it. It's, you know, the more detailed and the more criteria and exclusionary criteria there are, the harder it is to implement. The governor's priority list right now is incredibly detailed and difficult to understand, and so we hope it will be much more, it will be much simplified and easier to understand when we have vaccine to actually implement other tiers. Right now, though, the group of people 65 years of age and older in Jefferson County, I'm estimating at that there's 12,000 people in that group, and most of them are going to want the vaccine, and it's going to take us most of the month of February, I think, to get through that group, at least based on current vaccine projections. And then let's see. Oh, one last question, just asking if you get an adverse reaction to one vaccine, can you use another vaccine in the future to complete your vaccine series? And I would say, first of all, the good news is adverse vaccine reactions, serious allergic reactions, to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine are proving to be very rare, you know, 1 out of 100,000 doses. And so those are really pretty good odds that you're not going to get an adverse reaction. If you do get a serious allergic reaction to either of those two vaccines, you're advised not to take the second dose. And whether you can take one of these other vaccines that are being produced that use a different mechanism of immunizing people, that's simply unknown at this point. It's possible you could do it, but it would be a determination we'd make on a case-by-case basis. And medically, the way we try to do it is we would have to know why you had the allergic reaction. What in the vaccine were you allergic to? And is it in the other vaccine that you're contemplating taking? So that's the best we know at that point. And then there's one other question about, you know, if you're off by a few days. One person was concerned that their second dose of Pfizer vaccine was scheduled at 19 days instead of 21 days. Was that okay? And the answer is yes. You know, you can, with the Pfizer vaccine, it could be plus or minus a few days is fine. And the CDC has just come out and said, you know, you can be up to 6 weeks late. So in either vaccine, if you get it later than the recommended time, up to 6 weeks, that's still okay. There's evidence that it will be fully effective. So I think that's it for the questions.
Thank you, Dr. Locke. Thank you, Willie, for joining us. We will see you next Monday. And we're going to welcome Sheriff Joe Knoll. I need to jump off to go testify in a hearing and passing the gavel over to Greg. I do want to say that.
Hello, this is Robert Ambrose, KPTZ Board President and host of Rhythm Connection. Like you, I'm waiting to hear Dr. Locke's weekly COVID-19 update. I depend on KPTZ to hear this crucial information because it allows me to better understand how the virus is affecting our community. It also helps me gauge when I might see my distant new grandson. You'd depend on KPTZ to hear Dr. Locke too, and KPTZ depends on you to keep broadcasting. Please consider clicking on the Donate Now button at kptz.org to give us your support for our efforts. Thank you.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station.